From Texas to Ohio, Idaho to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, families and individuals own most of the nation's forest land, and they could better conserve those assets by receiving needed dollars from a robust carbon market. Rita Height from the American Forest Foundation is here to explain. President Joe Biden has rolled out a massive so-called infrastructure plan. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. The Centers for Disease Control have extended the COVID-related eviction moratorium until the end of June. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine explore the legality of the policy. And millions of Americans are getting COVID-19 vaccines. It's happening because of Donald Trump and Operation Warp Speed. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Carbon markets help landowners to generate an income from their forests that can be put back into conserving the land. Rita Height is Executive Vice President of External Affairs and Policy for the American Forest Foundation. She is here to talk about the importance of those markets. Rita, welcome to American Radio Journal. Rita, before we get into the specific issue here of carbon markets, tell us about forests that are privately and family owned, and what do these private and family landowners do with their forests, and how does this differ from public lands?
In the U.S., it's actually a little known fact that most of our forests are actually, a large portion of our forests are owned by families and individuals. A little over a third of our forests in the U.S. are owned by families, and that's the largest ownership group. So families own more land than the government. They own more land than corporations. And in fact, there's actually 21 million people in America that own forests, these families and individuals. And these families own their land for a whole diversity of reasons, everything from generating income. Many family landowners own their land for investment purposes. They own it to harvest the timber at some point. They own it as part of a farm or a ranch operation. So maybe they have cattle or sheep or other livestock or other crops. Some family landowners own a piece of land because it's been passed down for generations and generations and it's part of their family legacy. And still others are new to owning forests and wanted to purchase a piece of land to care for it and perhaps maybe pass it on to their kids and help their kids understand nature and the value of hard work in a rural area.
I suppose as with pretty much any type of agricultural or even manufacturing interest, Rita, that the federal government and federal regulations come into play. How heavily regulated are these family and individual owned forests?
All of the forest regulations that impact family lands are really formed at the state level. Across the country, there's a kind of a patchwork of both kind of voluntary systems as well as regulatory systems that support and enable family landowners to practice good stewardship, to care for their land, and pass it on. So, and the other thing I'll mention is the American Forest Foundation operates a program called the American Tree Farm System, and it was really founded on the principle that family landowners want to care for their land, they want to practice good stewardship, and they need tools to help them do that. And so programs like the American Tree Farm System really help set a system of standards that landowners can follow and create an infrastructure of technical assistance and foresters that can help landowners practice that stewardship through voluntary actions.
One of the potential areas where there can be a benefit here to the private and family-owned forest owners are carbon markets. Tell us what you mean by the term carbon markets. What are they?
Carbon markets have been around for a couple of decades now, and what we primarily are focused on is what are called voluntary carbon markets. These are markets that have been stood up largely because there's a corporation or a suite of corporations who want to take voluntary action to reduce their emissions as a corporation. And to do that, they can do things within their corporate, kind of inside their fence of the corporation, like energy efficiency and maybe changing fuels. But a lot of corporations can't do it all, can't get to some of their goals without utilizing something called a carbon offset or a carbon credit. And that's where they go outside of their corporate fence, per se, and purchase emissions reductions, carbon sequestration and storage from others. And so this sets up this market infrastructure where a corporation wants to take, again, a voluntary action to buy carbon reductions from another entity. And what we found with the carbon markets, and when you kind of look at the data around where the best potential is for carbon reductions and carbon sequestration and storage, our forests are actually one of the largest opportunities. Forests right now currently offset about 15% of the U.S.'s emissions from fossil fuels, and projections estimate that we could nearly double that. And so these corporations that are looking to, again, reduce their emissions can actually do that by purchasing carbon credits from forest owners who can help capture and store more carbon in their woods.
All of this, of course, based on the scientific fact that trees take in carbon dioxide and put off oxygen, correct?
Absolutely.
You have this value that forests provide in offsetting the production of CO2 from other sources. And as you mentioned, there's a carbon market. So in terms of these carbon markets, what sort of investment is required in order to make the carbon market system work?
This is a really important issue because while the carbon markets and these voluntary carbon markets exist and are growing, and in fact, some studies estimate that voluntary carbon markets could be worth somewhere around $50 billion by the end of this decade. But one of the biggest challenges that we see with these growing carbon markets is that most family forest owners, who again are a huge chunk of our forests in the U.S., currently cannot access these markets. Right now, about 98% of the forest projects that are in the kind of current markets are not small and family landowners. Only 1% of the projects are family forest owners. So this is a big problem. If we're going to tap forests through these voluntary markets, we've got to find ways to unlock these markets for forest owners, especially those small landowners.
What is the barrier to the small forest owner participating in these markets?
So the biggest barrier is really, it comes down to the finances, right? So it costs right now, kind of the current markets out there, the current mechanisms, it costs a lot to first determine what you can do in your woods. What are the things that you could do in your woods to add carbon, to sequester and store carbon? Then it requires you to develop a project and go through a process of determining the actions and identifying a registry, a place where you'll sell your carbon. Then there is a whole system of measuring and monitoring and verification. Again, these are all the kind of current program requirements to address a lot of these upfront costs, which were inhibiting most family landowners, because if you've got a small tract, the average family landowner in the U.S. has about 60 acres. And so if you've got a small tract like that, it's really hard to make carbon markets pencil out when you've got a lot of these upfront costs. And frankly, you don't return income from a carbon market until years later. Once you take the practice, you take the action in your woods, and then it takes sometimes a year, sometimes 20 years to actually generate the carbon in that you can sell in the market. So there's a lot of upfront costs to addressing and participating in the markets.
We have been talking with Rita Hite, who is Executive Vice President of External Affairs and Policy with the American Forest Foundation. We've been talking about carbon markets. And Rita, if we have listeners who would like to learn more, tell us where they can find you on the web, and also tell us a little bit about the American Forest Foundation.
The American Forest Foundation is a national conservation organization dedicated to empowering family landowners to achieve conservation impact. We work with the nation's family landowners to help them practice good stewardship and deliver important environmental outcomes and economic outcomes, like addressing climate change, like providing clean water and wildlife habitat. To learn more about the American Forest Foundation, you can visit www.forestfoundation.org.
Rita Hite of the American Forest Foundation. Rita, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He does keep an eye on what's happening in Congress, also what President Joe Biden is up to, and it's been a big week on the so-called infrastructure front. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
One of Joe Biden's major initiatives is something that he calls an infrastructure bill. Is that really what's at play here, Scott, or what's the president actually up to?
every president, when they take office, they've got major items on the agenda. And we've previously talked about the Democrats working in the House, Senate, and White House to pass sweeping election reforms that would really change elections as we know them and permanently create situation that leads to elections like 2020 where people have questions about voter integrity. And so today, what we're going to talk about is Biden's plan that he's calling the American Jobs Plan. And I think that that's really a stretch because what this thing's going to do is actually hurt the economy. We've seen Biden and the Democrats really try to enact major spending plans, and we've had trillions and trillions of dollars that have already gone out the door. And so what Biden did this week was propose another $2 trillion plan, the American Jobs Plan, that would attempt to repair the crumbling roads and bridges throughout the country. But that's just a small part of what's in the plan. He's also got a lot of money in there for things like affordable housing. He's got things in there for caregivers for the elderly and people with disabilities. And then he's also got a lot of spending for research, development, and manufacturing. So these four buckets is what I want to unpack with you today.
Let's drill down a little bit more into those buckets here, Scott. Whenever I think of infrastructure, and I think most people probably the same, we think about our roads and bridges. And I think most Americans know that a lot of our roads and bridges are in sad shape and something needs to be done. But this seems to be only a very small part of what the president's proposing. So how do we take an infrastructure plan and then it all of a sudden morphs into essentially funding the Green New Deal?
Yeah, well, even when you unpack the infrastructure bucket of the Biden plan, only $115 billion of the $621 billion that's dedicated toward transportation actually goes toward bridges, highways, roads, and main streets that are in need of repair. He's got $80 billion for one of his pet projects, Amtrak, which we all know is a huge boondoggle. It is an entity that has repeatedly failed to make a profit and is totally subsidized by the U.S. government. And then he's got $174 billion to prop up electric vehicles, including a network of over 500,000 electric vehicle stations. $174 billion for that. He's got $50 billion for something called infrastructure resiliency. Well, what does that mean? That's actually $50 billion for climate change. And then he wants to spend money on upgrading our airports. That's $25 billion. And improving road safety, whatever the heck that means, $20 billion. And the point that I want to make today to the listeners is that when a president puts out such ambiguous line items with a plan, the bottom line is this thing's going to be written and passed through the Congress, which is currently controlled by Democrats in the House and Senate. And so they've been clear in their agenda since AOC took office in January 2019. They want to enact a Green New Deal. And this infrastructure package, this jobs package, is a directive to Congress to take these broad categories and enact elements of the Green New Deal underneath them.
The flip side of the coin, if you will, here, Scott, to all of this spending is somehow we have to pay for it. And of course, we do know that the federal government keeps piling debt upon debt. But also, the president's proposing some very significant tax hikes, theoretically on corporations and high income earners. But we all know that perks down through the economy. Can you talk a little bit about what the president is proposing from a tax perspective?
In the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the corporate income tax rate dropped from 35% down to 21%. And Biden's tax proposal increases it back up to 28%. But he's also got tax increases on high income for individuals. So he wants to see that top rate go from 37% back up to 39.6%. And ultimately, this leads to what will be the largest tax increase in our nation's history. Biden is saying that that is in part to help pay for these investments, stimulus spending that he's trying to enact in Congress. But you've also got the Secretary of Transportation, former mayor in Indiana, Mayor Pete, now Secretary Pete Buttigieg, proposing a tax on mileage for how often and how far people drive. Well, let's think about what that means. Is that a regressive tax? Is that going to actually hurt the folks that are trying to drive to get to work? It turns into almost a Cadillac tax. So only the wealthy people that can afford to drive would be able to. Now, they would certainly achieve their goal of investments in more mass transportation programs and taking cars off the road. So you're going to have, in theory, less pollution from vehicles, which are actually pretty efficient in terms of not polluting right now. And I think that it's just, again, this lurch toward the left that the socialist radicals in Congress are trying to really jam down the throat of the U.S. economy.
We will, of course, keep very close eye on this as it unfolds in the coming weeks and months with Scott Parkinson. He, of course, is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners want to learn more, check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Despite questions over its authority to do so, the Centers for Disease Control have extended the COVID-19 eviction moratorium until the end of June. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine are here to discuss.
Despite the fact that three U.S. district courts in Tennessee, Ohio, and Texas have already rejected the Center for Disease Control's power grab in issuing an eviction moratorium, the CDC just keeps on extending it. Now, all the way through June, this is one of those, I think, underappreciated aspects of how the power of government has grown during the pandemic, and we're going to take a closer look at that today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is a colleague of mine, Christian Britschke. He's an associate editor at Reason Magazine and writes at Reason.com, and he's got a piece this week about the CDC's eviction moratorium that has been extended, as I said now, all the way through the end of June. Christian, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
This is something you've been following closely really throughout the pandemic, but I think it's something that probably most people aren't all that aware of, unless you're somebody maybe who's taking advantage of it. What exactly is the CDC saying here? It's banning all evictions?
It doesn't ban all evictions. It bans evictions for non-payment, meaning that your landlord can't kick you out of your unit if you haven't paid rent, if you've fallen behind on rent. And there's some restrictions on that, too. The tenant has to file a declaration saying that they have lost income, have made every effort to get government assistance, and also it's restricted to people making up to $99,000 a year or $198,000 for joint filers. And then also I should add on top of that, you can still be evicted for violating other terms of your lease besides like the paying rent part, or engaging in like criminal activity on the premises and whatnot. So yes, it protects you from being evicted if you haven't paid rent, but that's about it.
This is one of those classic examples of the government just only really looking at half the picture, right? I mean, this is meant ostensibly to protect people who are renters during the pandemic. You know, we don't want people thrown out in the streets, I guess, during the middle of a pandemic, but it's completely ignoring the other side of that economic equation, which is the landlords.
Right. It ignores the landlords in two ways. One is obviously kind of unfair to them, given that they're basically not allowed to reclaim their property from a tenant who isn't paying them. They're required to provide housing for free. But it also kind of misunderstands what the landlord's incentives are during down economic times during the pandemic. The idea is to prevent this mass wave of evictions because so many people are out of work. But, you know, if you have so many people out of work, the incentive for the landlord is generally to give a good tenant who, up until the pandemic, has been paying rent a pass, work something out with them. Because if they kick them out, it's not like there's going to be a bunch of other gainfully employed tenants ready to take spot. So I think it kind of misunderstands the landlord's perspective in two ways there.
It also seems like just an overreach, right? Like, I mean, the CDC, they've bungled some of the really essential functions that they have during the pandemic. And I guess I wondered why is this something the CDC is doing rather than, say, like Congress or state legislatures?
Just to give your listeners a little history here, the Trump administration issued this to the CDC in September. Congress actually did extend it for a brief period from late December to the end of January. Then the Biden administration has now extended it twice. So Congress has acted here. State legislatures have acted as well by issuing, or state legislatures, state governments, governors as well, have issued their own eviction moratorium. So there's been some action on this front. Why the CDC in particular is issuing an eviction moratorium, it has to do with the particular federal laws that they're relying on to justify this eviction moratorium, particularly the Public Health Services Act, which gives the CDC and related regulations, gives the CDC the power to take measures that are, quote-unquote, reasonably necessary to prevent the interstate spread of disease or of a communicable disease. And so the CDC is interpreting this to say that, hey, a eviction ban prevents people from moving into homeless shelters or moving in with family, potentially across state lines, that therefore, you know, and if they have COVID, they'll be spreading COVID with them when they move into this crowded situation. And so therefore, a eviction moratorium is a reasonable means of preventing spread of disease. Therefore, the federal government, in particular the CDC, is empowered under this law to do it.
We are talking with Christian Britschke from Reason Magazine about the CDC's eviction moratorium that's now been extended through June. Christian, the pandemic is somewhat coming to an end here, where vaccination rates are up, cases are down. The big question, I guess, now is whether this was a policy that actually saved anybody. I know government bureaucrats are great at coming up with justifications. You were just sort of laying out some of that for their own action. I know there have been, and you've covered for us at Reason.com, some studies that have supposedly found that these eviction moratoriums have helped suppress COVID-19 infections, but some of this is not really looking at the whole picture again, right?
So there's been a couple studies that have looked at state-level eviction policies and tried to measure the impact of COVID-19 infections and deaths once those have been lifted, compare that to states that kept their eviction moratoriums in place. And a couple studies that have come back have found that eviction moratoriums have had a significant impact on COVID deaths. However, I would point out a couple things about those studies. One is that they don't measure the number of evictions themselves. They just look at the policy, right? So we don't know if that, the studies don't look at whether you lift the eviction moratorium, you have a lot more evictions, and then therefore you have a lot of deaths. That data isn't in there, in part because it's just very difficult to get data on evictions. So I think there is some evidence that these eviction moratoriums have done good, but I would say that evidence is limited, definitely.
Yeah, it seems like just one of these things that's maybe underappreciated in terms of the size and scope of the government's restrictions on people's economic behavior during this pandemic, and one of those things that when this finally does expire again in June, hopefully is relegated away for good. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Christian Britschke from Reason Magazine, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
You can find Christian's work at Reason.com, and in the pages of Reason Magazine, you can check out everything else that we're working on there as well, including our coverage this week of Biden's new massively expensive infrastructure plan that he's rolling out on Wednesday afternoon. For more on all of that, head over to Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines is accelerating, providing some light at the end of the pandemic tunnel. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says, give credit to Donald Trump and Operation Warp Speed.
We're now full throttle into mass distribution of COVID vaccines. And let there be no doubt, their rapid development is an extraordinary achievement. I want to underscore that by revisiting what I said here in a commentary last spring, when I placed President Donald Trump's Operation Warp Speed into historical context. In fact, I look back, and I'm looking back now, particularly at the historic polio vaccine that was pioneered by Dr. Jonas Salk at the University of Pittsburgh in the 1950s. Salk's vaccine was announced in April 1955. But the push by the federal government began way back in January 1938 when a man named Basil O'Connor became President Franklin Roosevelt's point man to wage war on the disease, including through the creation of the March of Dimes. For the record, in 1935, two polio vaccines were announced by research teams led by Maurice Brody and John Colmer, but both were quickly shelved because vaccinated children died in clinical trials. So in 1949, Basil O'Connor upped the ante with a mass infusion of research dollars into a vaccine. Though the medical community was skeptical, Dr. Jonas Salk was not. Salk had harsh critics, especially a fellow researcher named Albert Sabin. Sabin's own oral vaccine wasn't released until 1961. In sum, it took many years, actually decades, to develop the polio vaccine, during which time things got worse, with 1952 being the worst polio outbreak yet. By contrast, the development of the COVID vaccines took well under a year, like 9 months. The swiftness of their development is unprecedented. To be sure, there are many reasons why COVID vaccines were developed so much quicker than polio vaccines. Consider, for instance, merely the example being researched once again at the University of Pittsburgh. Scientists at Pitt had already mapped out the genetic sequencing for COVID. To quote Pitt's Dr. Andrea Gamboto, "We had previous experience on SARS-CoV in 2003 and MERS-CoV in 2014. We knew exactly where to fight this new virus," unquote. But even then, whatever head start the COVID vaccines had over the polio vaccines, and whatever the superiority of modern technology, the breathtaking speed of the COVID vaccines is a stunning biomedical accomplishment. Recall that at the final presidential debate on October 22nd, the moderator, Kristen Welker, asked President Trump if he could guarantee that there would be a COVID vaccine within coming weeks. Donald Trump made a striking prediction. He said, quote, "I can't guarantee that, but it will be by the end of the year." Trump pointed to the three leading developers, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer, telling the national viewing audience that, quote, "they are doing very well," unquote. Joe Biden, he wasn't just incredulous of that remark by Trump, but snidely dismissive. He said to Welker and the national audience, he, meaning Donald Trump, he has no clear plan, and there's no prospect there's going to be a vaccine available for the majority of the American people before the middle of next year, unquote. That was Joe Biden, October 22nd. Guess what, folks? Less than 8 weeks later, Joe Biden rolled up his sleeve and was sticking out his arm in Willington, Delaware for his first dose of COVID vaccine. That is by the end of the year, just as Donald Trump had assured and just as Joe Biden had scoffed at. As Biden received his injection, he did give Trump some credit. He said, quote, "I think the administration," that is the Trump administration, "deserves some credit getting this off the ground with Operation Warp Speed," unquote. Biden's concession to Trump there as he and his wife got their Pfizer BioNTech injection has never gotten the media attention it should, not surprisingly. And it would be a great gesture of true unity, which Joe Biden says he wants, if Biden paused to more deliberately recognize Donald Trump's efforts. It really ought to be known as the Trump vaccine effort. Look, I've never been a cheerleader for Donald Trump, but I have a strong sense of justice and injustice. And it's terribly unjust not to give this man his share of due credit for this incredible accomplishment by and in partnership with the biomedical community. Operation Warp Speed, it worked. Give the reviled orange man his due. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WDQN-AM in DuQuoin, Illinois, KARI-AM in Blaine, Washington, along with KQSS-FM in Miami, Arizona. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.